right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, I'm back. Anyway, at the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I aired a few weeks ago. We're going to listen to my conversation with Jason Stanley, the author of How Fascism Works. And I'm replaying such a recent interview, which I rarely do, because of the times we're in and the increasing need to sound the alarms and wake people up. And I believe that you're going to agree once you hear this interview. Before that, we'll hear a newly released clip from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. This is the 60s, the heavy times to come, and the need for science, and the role for you. And it's from the video, Why We Need an Actual Revolution, and How We Can Really Make Revolution. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to bring back to this show somebody who seems to be looking all over the floor for something. Anyway, Noche Diaz.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing great. And for people who may not know at this point, Noche is part of the, he's part of the National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution Tour, and he's here to talk with us about that and a few other things. So Noche, tell people first off, what exactly is that tour?
So the National Revolution Tour began, people began coming from around the country in March to start the first leg of this. And the slogan of this tour is, you think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. And the point of this is that there's a group of people who have come together from around the country who, have taken up, and gotten into what Bob Avakian has developed, which is an actual strategy for making a revolution in this country, an actual way out of this madness. And we've determined to launch this effort to begin to bring forward what we don't have yet, which is the thousands of people who need to be working together all around the country to actually bring the days closer when we can really make this revolution and impact all of society and turn people's faces towards a real way out of the madness that humanity finds itself in today. And so this tour started off, in, like I said, mid to late March. We've been going around LA and also the surrounding areas, Sacramento, Vallejo, Orange County, Riverside, Stan State University. And we've been spreading this message of revolution and fighting for to develop new forms and new ways to involve people in a movement that is going to work to prepare the ground and prepare people and prepare a core of leadership for the days when we can really overthrow this whole system of white supremacy, male supremacy, U.S. global empire and destruction of the environment and the hounding and demonization of immigrants and refugees. Because this system has no answers for this. Whether it's Trump's braying about building a wall and demonizing all immigrant people, whether it's the way women are being dragged back to the dark ages, being denied the right to control their own bodies, or the video after video of police murder and brutality. Police were never punished for doing this against, everyone knows, black and brown people especially. All of this is something that none of these ruling class parties have any answer for, whether it's the fascists like Trump and his whole crew or the Democratic Party, including their more radical faces like, Bernie and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and a lot of them. They have no answers for what this system does to people here and all over the world. We do. Okay, we have a way out of this, and too many people don't even know about this and don't know that they have a place in making this revolution. And so we're going to work on with people, okay, with very new people who have just stepped into this, as well as people who have actually dedicated their lives to this, going to work to actually solve that problem and bring forward a real movement for revolution right here in the belly of the beast.
That's actually really important, and I think it's something people don't hear very often, and they need to hear it very often. And, let's dig a little bit more into this. Like, there's a question of actually, okay, you've said this, and you've told us the basic declaration and what it's all about. But let's talk about this a little bit more in terms of the plans you have, what you actually think is going to happen, what needs to happen. I mean, I think it's interesting when you were talking about bringing all these people together and the need to do that around this. And people busting through the chains that are put around their mind and their eyes and understanding what the reality of it is. So how are you doing that?
Big part of how we're doing that is we're going, like as I mentioned, that slogan of the tour of you think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. Because, look, there's millions of people who actually care about some or more or all of the things I was, briefly touching on. Millions of people actually do care about that. Some of the people listening to this show, part of the reason they listen to it is because they don't want to be ignorant fools to what's going on in the world, But most people are also caught up in, really having their heads up their asses in terms of, what's involved in really the scale, scope, and the stakes of the danger that humanity is facing, and in terms of the way out. And people are getting caught up in all kinds of things that go nowhere, solutions that don't solve. And so the big part of what this tour is doing is, you know, is actually shattering a lot of these, you know, this sleepwalking, you know, and not just waking people up in a fake kind of woke kind of way, but actually shaking up, you know, the discourse over what's the problem and what's the solution. And in that context, actually putting forward, look, you know, faced with the, you know, this is something Bob Avakian has said, faced with the world as it is, we really do have two choices. Okay, it's not because we say there's two choices, but because of the actual world that we live in and what humanity is facing, we have really two choices, which is that we live with all this in one form or another, and we condemn future generations to suffer the same hell or worse, or we make a revolution. And that living with this takes all kinds of forms, whether it's thinking about myself and how I can get by, or whether it's, oh, we got to accept the best that we can do in these circumstances is vote for this person or that person, or try to get a piece of the pie, you know, in terms of what America is doing to people all around the world and the wealth and plunder that's being extracted from this suffering, and try to redistribute it to more Americans. That's the Bernie program and the AOC. You know, this is all forms of actually living with this, but we actually can make the other choice, which is actually making revolution, and not just, you know, because we can be better people, because humanity is depending on us to actually do the right thing. Okay, and putting that squarely to people, this is the reality we face, but people don't want to look at it. Okay, so we're forcing people to look at that and actually saying this is not just like a gut check. There's a way to go to work on this, you know. We have these 6 points of attention for the revolution, which is a basic way that people can get the principles and guidelines and goals and methods of the revolution and go to work together with each other to begin organizing people. And, you know, you don't have to know everything about revolution to get started. Everyone starts somewhere, and everybody can't do everything, but everybody can do something. Okay, so long as it's, you know, guided by these principles, this can actually be important ways that people contribute to an overall movement that's working together throughout the country and that's being built. That's growing over the course of the next year into a real force in society that is actually, you know, an alternative to all the sleepwalking or the turning inward or the depression and demoralization that afflicts people who look at squarely at some things and determine that, oh, nothing is possible. And all this is because we actually do have a way to deal with this. You know, Bob Avakian is not some savior. He's someone who's done a whole lot of work on looking at why this system is the way it is, why it can't be reformed, and what we have to do is overthrow it. How do we solve the problems of the revolution? He's developed a lot of methods, you know, to approach those questions. He's developed a strategy. He's written a constitution to run a new society to deal with all this. But what we don't have is people who are working on wielding that, you know, that same strategy and method to go to work on the problems of how do we actually make a real force. Because if we don't do that, if people don't begin to step forward and do that, then it is really just that, yes, a different world is possible, but there's no real force to make that real. So that's why, you know, that's why I'm on here to talk with you, not just you, Michael. You know, I mean, you're fine, but I'm here to talk to you in terms of the people who are listening. You know, now is the time to actually step forward and become part of the ranks of the revolution. How long is this going to go on, and when will enough be enough? You know, I was talking to some people last weekend, and, you know, it's like watching this video of this 12-year-old boy in Sacramento. Young black man, 12 years old, chased through a parking lot by the security, who then called police out on him, who corralled him, threw a bag over his head, dragged him to the ground while he cried out, "I can't breathe," just like Eric Garner before his life was snuffed out. How long is this going to go on, and when is enough enough? At the same time, you know, state after state is passing, you know, these barbaric feudal laws that say, you know, women are basically breeders and incubators for men's babies, okay? They can't even control their own bodies. After 30, 40 years of people trying to play defense to hold on to some of the gains of the women's movements, you know, like Roe v. Wade, being dragged down and pushed down further into the shadows, talking about now having to make underground railroads for women to seek out abortions. When is enough enough? And how long are people going to be played into this position of just going along with this or seeking solutions that don't deal with it and retreating further and further into the shadows while the planet is almost literally burning around us, a million species going extinct? When is enough enough? You know, this country sending, over 1,000 troops into the surround Iran and making all kinds of threats right now of war and besides, this nut is actually threatening, threatens the world with nuclear annihilation because we have a demented fascist Donald Trump with his finger on the nuclear button. When is enough enough, okay? You don't have to wait until you've figured everything out to actually make that first step. People need to step in now. Everybody who, you know, is listening right now, whether you're in your car or on your phone, however you listen to this, you need to come together with others like you and who are nothing like you except that they also have had enough. There is a force that is growing, building, and organizing for a revolution right here in the belly of the beast. And you, listening, have to be one of those people who are going to be there making that declaration. How do we impact? Where did the word about this have to get out? What are the kinds of things to bring alive that there is a way now to fight against the outrages of this system and to work to organize, to build up the forces to actually put an end to this madness?
All right, Noche Diaz, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And you want to be part of the whole movement to actually that actually is built around this system cannot be reformed. It must be overthrown. The National Get Organized for an Actual Revolution Tour. And Noche, thank you very much for joining us today. That was Noche Diaz from the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution Tour talking about why this system cannot be reformed. It must be overthrown. Now we'll hear something from Bob Avakian, BA. The 60s, the heavy times to come, the need for science, and the role for you. This is taken from the video, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution.
With all this complexity, if you are not approaching it scientifically, you're going to be out of it. It's not like this is a magic thing that you're going to always do right if you're struggling to apply science in a consistent way. But you have no chance otherwise. If you think about all the complexity that goes into this, and this is why we need, as I said, to bring forward not just one or two, but, you know, dozens and eventually hundreds and thousands of people who are capable of being leaders of this revolution on all different levels and are continuing to learn more and lead better as they do. This cannot be made by just a small handful of people. You know, we can start with a relatively small number of people, which we are, but then we have to go out and build this whole thing and, you know, get this whole process going where wave after wave, more people are becoming part of the revolution and are learning to become leaders, because everybody can learn this. Now look, I'm not gonna lie, I'm not gonna pretend that if you've been involved for 6 months, you're gonna be able to lead on the same level as someone who's been working at this for decades. And assuming that person has been working for it for decades, has been working for it in the right way, which gets me to a question you raised about the Cultural Revolution in the party and why we had to have one, because the party had gone off track and it had lost its revolutionary orientation. Look, one of the things I talked about, the 1968 and that whole period of what's generally referred to as the 1960s or whatever, there was a great revolutionary upheaval then, but then the world changed. There wasn't a revolution in this country. The Vietnam War ended in a certain way that wasn't, in the short run, it was a great defeat for U.S. imperialism and a good thing, a very good thing for the people of the world. But then the way things went in the world was not that the revolutionary people. I remember the first time I met Huey Newton back in, I don't know when it was, 1966, I guess. And I told the story in my memoir. I went to a cultural program, African-American cultural program at a local community college. And he came up to me because I was, I guess, you know, one of maybe two white people there. And he came up to me and said, "Who are you, Socrates?" Because I had a beard and so on. And I said, "No." And, you know, and I guess he thought I looked philosophical or something. And, you know, but then I remember we started talking and he said, "Are you in this group?" And I said, "No." And he said, "That's good. They're not revolutionary. Are you in that group?" "No." "That's good. They're not revolutionary." But then when he started talking about revolution, the idea he had was sort of that in the third world, there was this wave of anti-colonial struggles and revolutionary wars and so on. And so that, as he put it to me then, two-thirds of the people in the world are on our side. So we're bound to win. Well, that was kind of a naive understanding. You know, I don't have time to go into the whole thing, but Huey Newton played a very important and advanced role at a certain period. But all of us were, you know, very undeveloped in our understanding and not approaching things scientifically very much at that point. And when things changed, when this wave of anti-colonial struggles ebbed and turned into something else. And then socialism was lost in China when capitalism got restored there, which is something that was a major development in the world, although they don't tell you about it in those terms. They act like it's still communist or something because the party still calls itself communist. Anybody can call themselves anything they want. The question is, again, scientifically analyzing, what are they actually? What are they actually doing? They've restored capitalism there. That's what they're doing. So they can keep the label communist because it's politically useful to them at this point. But that doesn't mean they are communist. You look at the actual content of what they're doing and scientifically analyze it. So all these things were happening that were, and then there was an assault, a concentrated assault, particularly beginning with the presidency of Ronald Reagan and everything associated with that, beginning in 1980, an assault on everything that the 1960s had been, all the positive things that the 1960s had been about. The struggle against racism and white supremacy and the struggle around women and the right to abortion and the oppression of women, all that, and on, all these things came under a concerted attack from a powerful section of the ruling class. And, with all these changes in this country, and they were, doing what we used to call reversing verdicts. In other words, people through the 60s learned a whole lot about the history of this country that I was speaking to at the beginning of my talk here, and about the role of this country in the world. A lot of people learned that stuff, and then there was a concerted attack to say that all that was wrong and to re-propagandize people with the notion that this is a very special country, a shining city on the hill, American exceptionalism. This country wasn't founded on slavery, it was founded on freedom, all this kind of stuff. And then there was all along that a concerted, determined struggle to slander and distort the experience of socialism, not only in the Soviet Union, but especially in China, which was the most advanced experience we've had of a socialist society, even while there were real shortcomings there. So the effect of all this, we don't live in a, isolated chamber. The revolutionaries and the communists in the world don't live in an isolated chamber where what's happening out there, we go out and try to change the world, but the world doesn't affect us. We're, part of this world and affected by it, and all this kind of, everything I was just describing, wave after wave after wave of counter-revolutionary political and ideological assault on everything positive about the 60s and all the experience of the great experience of socialism, and in particular China and the Cultural Revolution, all that begins to wear on people, and you start thinking, we were for revolution, we're still for revolution, we're still for socialism and communism, but maybe that's going to happen some other time or some other place. Right now, we're just kind of going along, keeping on, raising the banner. And also, people were still skating to a large degree on what had been the understanding coming out of the 60s. I talked about the viewpoint that Huey Newton put forward in talking to me. And it had an influence on me, a positive influence. It pushed me in the direction of revolution, just to be clear. But it wasn't a real correct scientific understanding of what was going on in the world and all the contradictions. And if you came out of that period, here's what you sort of thought if you came out of that period from the 60s. There was this whole wave where more and more people were becoming more and more alienated from and defiant against the system and wanting a radical change and having revolutionary sentiments. It went from, thousands to millions, millions and millions of people. So George W. Bush was part of that generation, but he doesn't count. A whole generation of people went that way, including in the middle class, in the university students, millions of them. And you kind of, there was a song by, I can't remember the name of the group right now, I'm kind of tired, but Quicksilver Messenger Service, this song, What About Me? And it was basically about, look, me, meaning us, we're everywhere. We're in your factories, we're in your schools, we're even in your army. What are you going to do about me? You know, I believe, and I had a line in there, I believe the revolution is close at hand. I mean, this was a, okay, they weren't quite, you know, Bob Dylan in terms of their impact in society. They weren't quite Jefferson Airplane, if you know about them. But they were a significant group, musical group, that came out of the Bay Area, doing this song about, I believe the revolution is close at hand. And pretty much on you know, right on about what that meant in general terms. But there was kind of this understanding, this is going to keep going and going and going, and more people are going to get with it. And eventually it was just going to become so big that somehow we're just going to kind of, you know, wash them away. I mean, nobody, maybe not everybody certainly would have articulated it exactly that way, but that was sort of the sentiment and the basic understanding. And then when all that ebbed and it didn't happen, people became very disoriented. And even the communists, even in the party, were, a lot of people were still going along with that kind of outlook, and when that's not what's happening, then you start to doubt everything. Well, maybe we were wrong, since it's the masses of people who make revolution and the masses of people are not in a revolutionary mood, I guess we're wrong about revolution. All these kind of things, and you know, at a certain point, it became clear to me, if we keep going like this, we're going to throw the whole thing away. And that would be, you know, a tremendous betrayal of the masses of people, because one of the things that was very positive that did come out of the 60s was that you did have a revolutionary communist party. It was formed out of that whole experience that could play a vanguard role in actually working toward a revolution, the revolution that was needed. And here it was about ready to just totally go down the drain. And what a betrayal that would be. So that's why we had to have a cultural revolution in the party to say, we got to get back on the revolutionary track. And in order to do that, we have to become much more scientific. We have to really scientifically dig into what goes into a revolution. What is the problem and what is the solution? And all of its complexity and all the contradictions that have been talked about. And that's a continuing struggle. And look, the reason that I wanted to do what we're doing here today is because we need a lot of new people to come into this revolution, become part of this revolution, help to solve the problems of the revolution. I know you might be saying, well, what, you know, how am I going to solve the problems of the revolution? I just heard about this 6 weeks ago. Well, everybody starts somewhere, you know, and everybody has things to contribute. And we really need people to become part of this revolution. And, you know, like I said, people should start with what they, you know, can readily do and feel confident doing, that can contribute and learn more and contribute more and keep advancing. And come in at the point which you're convinced about all of this, including the atheism, come into the party and help to strengthen the party to be the revolutionary vanguard it needs to be. And meanwhile, go out there and work among broader numbers of people, even while you're learning and struggling and determining whether you do agree with all of it. Help bring forward more people to be part of this process so that we can actually very quickly, and I don't mean in a week or a month, but we don't have indefinite time. Look what's going on in the world. So that we can move to where there are thousands of people organized into this revolution. And believe me, if there are thousands of people organized into this revolution, all acting in a unified way, not, I don't mean like, boo, I think the same thing as you, I don't have any ideas of my own. No. But I mean having a scientific approach, and struggling together to recognize and solve the problems of the revolution. If you have thousands of people who are doing that, you're going to influence and impact the whole society in a very big way. So this is what we need. You know, it's, look, I've said this before, it has to be understood in the right way, but the millions and billions of suffering people in the world are counting on us even though they don't know it. And a lot of them will tell us that we're wrong and you don't know what you're talking about. I was going to swear, but I've done enough swearing for today. But you don't know what you're talking about. You know, that's not going to get anywhere. Nobody's down with that. Even all those people who tell us that are, even though they don't know it, they're counting on us in a real sense, because this, what is represented by what we're talking about and grappling with here, is the only way forward out of this madness for these masses, millions and literally billions of people, whether they know it yet or not. So this is a responsibility that we're all called on to take up and contribute in whatever ways we can while we're learning more and struggling with each other and struggling to understand things more deeply and saying what we think is wrong if we think something is wrong and fighting it out. I don't mean this way, but I mean, you know, struggling it out to figure out what's right and how to go forward. This is what we all are called on to do. And to go out and get, you know, what we're called on to do most of all is to go out and bring forward a lot more people to become part of this with us.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a whole new synthesis of communism, the new communism. Now, this was the 60s, the heavy times to come, and the need for science and the role for you. And it's taken from the video, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You can find that whole film at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. That was Quicksilver Messenger Services piece, What About Me? We're going to be talking with Jason Stanley, philosophy professor at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. Now, Jason Stanley's parents survived the Holocaust in Germany, though millions of people did not, and he has spent the last 10 years studying fascism. He wants to scare us all, as someone said. I actually think he wants to ring the bell. And I like that Spike Lee film, Ring the Bell, and shouting to people, wake up, wake up, wake up. And he's here to talk with us about Donald Trump, the rise of fascism, what it means, and how people should be reacting. So, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I have 100 questions for you, okay?
Shoot.
Okay. You know, I saw a clip in an event you did in Chicago, and you talked there. You started with a story about your father sitting you down and telling you about the reality of America and the America First movement. And, you know, I guess actually I hadn't been studied up on all this in the America First movement and the relationship between that and what your dad was telling you and what's going on in the country today. Let's talk about that.
So we have a president who's explicitly referencing the America First movement. If you look at history, if you look at, say, Bradley Hart's recent book, Hitler's American Friends, it's got like 5 chapters, I think, in it. One of the chapters is on the America First movement. The Nazis thought the America First movement and its representative, Charles Lindbergh, its spokesperson, was their main hope in the United States. I mean, we had a very healthy fascist movement. It obviously had clear links to a homegrown movement, the Ku Klux Klan, whose ideology is very much overlaps with German fascism. And we had this long history of white supremacy, white nationalism. I mean, it's not a history, it's our present. It's something that the United States always struggles with. And Charles Lindbergh writes in the Reader's Digest that it's time to build our walls, build our ramparts high to protect the white race against the Mongol horde, against the Persian horde, the Arab horde, you know, This is a long history of racial demagoguery against non-whites, and that's what we're tapping into in the current moment.
Yeah, you know, it's very heavy because it's like there's that, what you're talking about in terms of this long history, and then there is the reality of today, which really, it really struck me because this, the aspect of people actually needing to know that what is the history of fascism and what it is in the U.S. and the fact that it isn't something foreign. It has a long and deep history. But the problem is that there's, you know, people don't realize even in this sense. I mean, I was, one of the things that really surprised me in reading your book was you made a point that actually it's not like the U.S. is free from all this or is just following what happened in Germany and other places, but that actually...
Vice versa.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Germans were deeply influenced by the U.S. case. I mean, people don't understand what an outlier the United States was with its one-drop rule about that you were not white, you were black if you had one drop of blackness. As James Whitman discusses in Hitler's American Model, the Nuremberg lawyers carefully studied our anti-miscegenation laws and based the Nuremberg laws upon them, although they decided that one drop was untethered from reality and went instead with one-eighth. You're Jewish if you're one-eighth Jewish. So our racial laws were even too extreme for the National Socialists. Now, of course, time has changed, and we've fought. The story of America is the story of our struggle with white supremacy, and it's always a difficult struggle, and it's very slow movement and slipping back. Look at the PBS documentary Reconstruction. I mean, I was taught in school that Reconstruction failed. After the Civil War, they give 4 million black people to vote, and then suddenly there are black congressmen and senators and people in the state legislatures, and they panic and they remove the vote. And I was taught that was because black people couldn't self-govern. So, you know, so we have this long history, and what we're seeing with Trump is an aspect. Trump is very American, but he's also very fascist.
Yeah, we're going to get into that in a minute, because there's a couple of other things I wanted to ask you first. You know, this thing that you just what you're starting to talk about, and the whole idea that, look, for me, it was really interesting in reading your book. It was, and I really recommend that people get this book. It's well worth sitting down, reading it, and rereading it. And it's Jason Stanley, How Fascism Works. You know, one of the things that really struck me there was that there really is this sort of all the various structural problems in the U.S. and how that actually brought people forward, not in a way to actually deal with all this stuff, in a way that could actually, you know, be, I don't know, whatever you would call digging in to try and do things in the right way and get, you know, get all this other stuff settled. It actually, you have people, the structural problems in the U.S. are bringing forward people that are helping them turning to fascism, which is really, you know, that is something I think people don't understand here.
Yeah, I mean, this is very clear in the literature on European fascism. Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism, Chapter 10, is all about how fascism emerges when people become lonely, when you break down labor movements, when you break down movements that bring people together to better their lives. Then when they become lonely and isolated due to the deprivations of capitalism, then they turn for solace to identity movements that give them false, fake hopes of meaning. I mean, I don't think the thing about fascism is it's not good for white people. You know, it's not good for the people that it claims to be good for. As Hannah Arendt says, you know, fascism, you know, claims to advance the race, but in fact, it's just advancing the interests of those who are making these false promises. But those false what happens in these moments when people are isolated and afraid about their economic insecurity, is that they desire to see some kind of victory, and they'll sacrifice their own well-being if they think that their enemies, the liberals, the elites, are being humiliated and are being aggravated. So that's fascist politics. Fascist politics says, we're not going to give you anything. You're not going to get anything out of this, but what you will get is we're going to torment the people you hate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's jump into this, the structure of fascism and why it's so dangerous. I mean, that's something I think people really need to understand pretty deeply.
Right. So my book is divided into 10 chapters. Each chapter covers a different aspect of fascist politics. And for me, you know, the United States is not governed like it's not a fascist government right now. We have elements of that with our prison industrial system, with the carceral state. But we're not a fascist country by any means. But we're talking about political tactics. Fascism is best thought of as a set of political tactics that breaks down democratic ideals. Let's begin with what democratic ideals are. Democratic ideals are liberty and equality. And both of those are based on truth. If you've been lied to, nobody thinks the people of North Korea are free. They've been lied to, so that's why they're not free. They'll vote for dear leader every time because they've been lied to. Liberty requires truth. Equality requires truth because truth is speaking truth to power is how you equalize. So a democratic culture requires people to have respect for the truth because that's how you equalize. So it requires, like, if a very powerful person lies and someone says, "You're lying," that very powerful person will be humiliated, and if they lie too much, they won't be able to participate in public life. If you lose that, you lose your democratic culture, because then a powerless person can't call out a powerful person. So let me start by running down quickly the 10 chapters. The first tactic is the mythic past. All of fascist tactics are based on a big lie, because that's the way to get you to detach from the truth. So the mythic past, we were once great, but we've been humiliated on the national stage. So you could see President Trump did this in the 2016 election. Obama bowed and scraped. He didn't throw American power around. He humiliated us. We're going to return to our greatness. We were once great, you know, wink, wink, about when that once was. Propaganda. There's a certain kind of propaganda that is very clear in fascism when things mean they're opposite. Like, all fascist campaigns are anti-corruption campaigns. Even though the fascists themselves are more corrupt than anyone else, they tar their opponents with corruption because they say this is useful for many reasons, but corruption means the wrong people are in charge. Chapter 3 is anti-intellectualism. You attack the press and the universities. So you should always worry when there's a systematic attack on the universities for being left-wing ideological indoctrination centers. So you attack the intellectual bastions, the press, for peddling leftism and liberalism under the guise of objectivity. You attack the universities for being like dens of Marxism and cultural Marxism. In Hungary, they just shut down the best university in Hungary, Central European University, for gender ideology and liberalism. So you always have to worry when there's a big attack on the universities and the press. Chapter 4, unreality. You float conspiracy theories. My first New York Times piece in 2011 was about birtherism, because knowing the history of fascism, that panicked me. There's a way that conspiracy theories work. All the evidence against the conspiracy theories is actually treated as evidence for them. So the way the Nazis floated the protocols of the Elders of Zion, the Jews own the presses, they run the universities, they run the film and theater industry. And then when the presses refused to report on the protocols of the Elders of Zion, that was more evidence. Look, the press is not reporting that the Jews run the press. That just shows the Jews run the press. Similarly, President Trump in 2012 said, you can tell CNN is owned by Obama because they're controlled by Obama because they don't report on birtherism. So unreality, you destabilize people. So nobody knows what the truth is anymore, and they forget the truth. And they're like, I don't care about the truth. I know my guy is lying, but he's my guy. He's us. And his lies drive the other side crazy, and that's what I like. You know, so that's the fascist political sphere. It's just us versus them. Reality's irrelevant. Chapter 5 is hierarchy. You know, equality is a myth. Feminism is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black Lives Matter is not seeking equality. It's seeking to take over. Black people are seeking to take over. They don't want equality. So you represent the dominant group feels victimized. Trump supporters think the most victimized group in America are white Christians. So that goes into Chapter 6, victimhood. You have this incredible tapping of victimhood of the dominant group. The Nazis were like, the Germans are the most persecuted people in the world. We lost our empire. So you have this sense, you cultivate the sense that the persecuted people who are losing their traditions are the dominant group. And what are they victims of? Chapter 7 is law and order. They're victims of crime, of gangs, because those foreigners, and they're bringing in crime and drugs and gangs. So in Austria, Kickl, the far-right minister, he went around and told the police stations. They're not allowed to talk to the mainstream press unless to report rapes of Austrian women by immigrants. So you create panicked fear about gang members and rapists, and that leads to the next chapter, which is sexual anxiety. You know, what crime do they do? Well, they do the crime of, they're rapists. We have to protect our women, and that's why we need a strong leader, because the strong leader is going to build a wall and protect our women from the foreigners. And you raise panic about homosexuality. You raise panic about turning boys into girls, because it's manlyhood that's prized in fascist politics. It's patriarchy. And then the first real fascist politics we had in recent years was Sarah Palin. So that hit the Chapter 9, Sodom and Gomorrah. The cities are the places of decadence and liberalism. That's where everyone mixes together. Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf is called Mein Time in Vienna. And he says, in Vienna, there were foreigners everywhere, foreign languages, and Jews, and more Jews. So the hated outgroup always lives in the cities. Think of what the expression inner city means in America. Cities are where black people live. It's where the immigrants live. And so you create the real Americans live in the countryside, rural versus urban divide. And Chapter 10 is called Arbeit macht frei, which was emblazoned on the gates of Auschwitz. Work shall make you free. Time and time again, the outgroup is always lazy. They're drains on the state, and you need to make them work for free in order to earn a work ethic. And that is at the heart. So that's why the idea in Nazi Germany was that Jews were lazy and never did any work. And they just got money because the government gave them, they worked in banking, and they just got money from interest and just were lazy. And you had to force them to work to give them a work ethic. And that's what is happening in our prison system right now. And then you target labor unions, because labor unions, are about, making workers' lives easier. But you need to break down labor unions, because labor unions forge connections across racial divides.
Yeah, this is incredible, actually. And let me make a quick announcement here. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Jason Stanley, who is the author of the book, How Fascism Works. So let's get back into it. Now, Jason, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, and you've been hitting at some of it, but there's this point about why exactly this is so dangerous, because you're thinking like, okay, you go through this, you have Lindbergh, all these people early on talking about fascism. Fascism raises its head, throughout the decades that we've been around, that we've been alive over, since the 1920s all the way up, or 1930. You have, who was it? Is it Bannon that talked about it's going to be a good year because it's a lot like 1930, something like that.
He said we're going to, in a Hollywood Reporter interview, he said it's going to be exciting like the 1930s. Yeah. Now, he's always winking. So, yeah, that's the decade he goes back to, and that's the decade where the United – now, it's tricky because Bannon has plausible deniability. He'll say, I meant the New Deal, but I'm skeptical that he meant the New Deal.
Yeah, I think you're right to be skeptical. It's sort of – yeah. But the thing is like when you – and that gets into this character of the fascist tactics. And, it is really – there's something that you keep bringing up in your book that really struck me, that fascism seeks to replace truth by power, and that there's a very particular method to doing that. Let's talk about that.
So – the method is you get people, you try to replace, so truth balances out loyalty. If we recognize the truth, if we recognize facts, so I don't mean like a deep truth. So people think that the Russian language makes a distinction between deep truth and truth. So that's why that covers propaganda. You lie, but you lie to reveal a deeper truth. I'm talking about just facts. So the enemy of fascism is just facts, just ordinary facts. Because ordinary facts, if everyone has loyalty to ordinary facts, then, it's hard to get away with stuff. They're just ordinary facts. And you have to have, a democratic culture requires that people are humiliated when they lie about ordinary facts. But what you try to do is you try to say, look, the whole system is corrupt. Everybody's lying. Think of Fox News's slogan, old slogan, fair and balanced. Everyone knew Fox News was not fair and balanced. The point of that slogan was to suggest that no one is fair and balanced, that Fox News is just as fair and balanced as everyone else, meaning not fair and balanced at all, because everyone is corrupt, everyone is lying. So you break down trust. You break down trust between citizens. So everyone is just like, okay, I don't know what's true anymore. I don't even care what's true. I just care about my guy winning, and I care about my guy winning and humiliating those liberal cosmopolitan elites and making them feel miserable, what we call owning the libs. And if you go back throughout fascist politics to the 1930s, to the German and Italian fascist movements, that's what it was about. It's about humiliating the elite. It was about bringing them down and, you know, and doing it in the service of your guy gaining power. And so it's like following sports teams. Sports is healthy because it takes away our fascist inclinations and focuses them on something it's fine to root for. It's totally fine for me to be like a total supporter of the New York Knicks because, you know, painful as it is in recent years, you know, that's my team. But that's not the attitude you want to bring to politics. The Democratic Party is not your team. The Republican Party is not your team. The truth is your team. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to raise conspiracy theories to try to humiliate the opponent, to try to just tar them with worst things ever, and just make politics into spectacle and show instead of, that's the other thing that we find. So you find Arendt talking about that all the time. She said, in fascism, people are glued to the screen. They're no longer, the news is no longer the news. The news is entertainment. The news is like, what's happening now in the ever crazy turmoil of the administration? Who's in? Who's out? And then no one is following anymore. They get addicted to this like spectacle of excitement. And then, you know, instead of like the boring policy of healthy democratic give and take.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things as you're talking, I kept going back to this where you get, you know, you talk about in the book, you talk about, you know, Hitler and value comes from victory and struggle, as you've been pointing to. But that also that if you want to get rid of political equality, you actually, this is what you do. You get rid of people's respect for the truth, which is really an interesting thing to posit.
Absolutely. The truth is much more important than people realize, and people are giving it up just to, like, own the libs far too easily. You know, Trump supporters understand he's lying constantly, but think it's cool. They think it's cool because it you know, triggers the libs. But, you know, if we all step back, Trump supporters and non-Trump supporters, and say, how about we go back to a culture where we just focus on the truth and it's not about, like, humiliating people anymore, because that's not a politics, actually. Politics should be like, here's this, you know, let's talk about a $1 wage raise. Let's talk about the weekend and how we're losing the weekend. Like, I kind of like the weekend. It took the unions a long time to get us the weekend. Let's hold on to the weekend. You know, and it, to get people back to that level and to get people back to respecting the truth, it's a humble thing. It's a little thing, but it's the center of democratic culture.
Mm-hmm. Now, you think about this. It's, you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about, you also go into a section in your book where you talk about that thinking of the normalcy of fascist ideology, you know, that there's a normalization of that going on, and it's very dangerous. And if you think about that, you bring up the term American exceptionalism, and it's constantly brought up generation after generation, and this is very dangerous.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. So part two of Hannah Arendt's Origins of Totalitarianism is called imperialism. M.A. Césaire in Discourse on Colonialism speaks regularly about, he says, Hitler's the worst person on earth, not because of what he did, but because of who he did it to, Europeans. He was doing to Europeans what the Belgians had done in the Congo when they killed 10 million people, like imperialism. And Hitler, of course, was infuriated, as Du Bois and The World in Africa brings out, was infuriated by the loss of the German colonies in Africa. Imperialism, the idea that the world is yours, is a very dangerous thing. So 9/11 really triggered a lot of what's happening now. Because 9/11 was, we lied ourselves, we got comfortable lying ourselves into a colonial war. We sold ourselves on we're spreading democracy. And here's the thing. I mean, Trump was very sophisticated about this, and I respect him immensely for the intelligence this took. He said, we're not good. Look at the Iraq War. So that always happens. When you become hypocritical with your colonialism, when it becomes just too obvious that you're not spreading democracy, you're in fact crushing people under your boot, then someone is going to come and say, hey, crush, that's what we do. We crush people under our boot. And that's fascism.
Mm-hmm. You know,
so
what
imperialism leads directly to fascism. The Iraq War led directly to our moment.
Boy, that's pretty heavy. Wow. Tell me this. this thing you talk about in the book about fascist inversion and ideas used to undermine themselves. And then I was thinking about that whole process actually can be used to undermine the entire society. You know, these anti-corruption campaigns, the unreality you referred to earlier, and then something that you also talk about, which we'll get into in a minute, but the victimhood that's actually been really out there now. So let's just first talk about this fascist inversion. What do you mean by that, and why is it so dangerous?
So remember there was a Saturday Night Live early on in the Trump administration where they had the Breaking Bad actor, played the Walter White character, come and as the new head of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as a joke, you know, because Trump kept on appointing people who were the opposite of their agencies. Mick Mulvaney was running the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Everyone running, you know, he put Rick Perry as the Secretary of Energy. I believe the Secretary of Energy. He put people who wanted to dismantle the very agencies they were running as head of the agencies. So he was inverting everything. So fascists run. So I talk about the example. I mean, this inversion point is familiar from literature. George Orwell's 1984, War is Peace. So think about, do you know what the name of Guantanamo Bay is? Camp Justice. Mm. So this inversion where you represent things as their opposite. So how was Trump able to run an anti-corruption campaign? I mean, the New York Times investigation revealed the depths of his corruption, of his business corruption. So how is he able to run this anti-corruption campaign? Well, he's able to run it by painting the system as corrupt and rigged. And to be honest, the system had a lot of was pretty corrupt and rigged. But that's very dangerous when that happens. When you can paint the system as corrupt and rigged, then you can run. Then the corrupt candidate becomes like the authentic candidate. He's the one who's openly corrupt, and everyone's like, well, he's not hiding anything. He's openly corrupt. And so they can be the anti-corruption candidate. But it's a joke. Then they run and then they go into office. He's representing the little man. He has a $1.5 trillion tax cut for the oligarchs that fund him and himself. So everything means it's opposite, but it's fine because he's triggering the libs.
Mm-hmm. Boy. All right, I have a couple more questions here for you. And when we're talking about this, it's part of this thing of, I don't know, it's sort of like the, you know, you've just been talking about a little, the politics of fascism, of pollution and corruption. But there's another thing that actually sticks out really, really sharply in relation to Trump and fascism and the situation of people in this country and in the world right now. And in particular, I was really intrigued by this thing of Trump and young black men who by their existence, their very existence, are violations of law and order, labeled rapists or whatever. Young black men are targets under this fascist stuff.
Right. So things don't mean, under fascism, things mean their opposite. They don't mean, so law and order doesn't mean law and order. So as I talk about in the book, when Jeff Sessions in November 2016 said, you can tell from Trump's response to the Central Park Five case that he's going to be a law and order president. What was meant by that? The Central Park Five were five completely innocent young black men who were arrested for a crime. They did not commit. And every possible, there was no physical evidence connecting them to the crime. There was the sperm found there was later shown to be the sperm of a convicted rapist who was on a spree at the time. So they were completely innocent, and they got a settlement from New York City. And Trump said, no, they're guilty. New York City shouldn't have paid the settlement. So what does it mean that Sessions said, oh, he's a law and order president? Law and order is punishing, is making sure that people who are guilty for the crimes that society is protected from them and we do something about that situation. It doesn't mean punishing the innocent for crimes they didn't do. Well, law and order under fascist politics means the out-group, the young Hispanic men, young black men, they are, by their very nature, violations of law and order. They're criminals. The Nazis, too, painted the German Jews as criminals. When the Nazis ran, they said, we're going to imprison all the criminal Jews. And many Jewish people said, okay, they're not going after me. But it turned out they meant people with traffic tickets, speeding tickets, exactly what's happening with immigrants right now.
Mm. All right, one last question, and this is one that actually I think is, I think it's imperative for people to pay attention to. It's the chapter Arbeit macht frei. And I wanted to ask you about that because it's actually something that, I think in some ways brings together everything that you've just been talking about. So let's get into that.
So Arbeit macht frei is about the fact, so fascism is based on social Darwinism. So social Darwinism is the view that value goes with whoever, with the winner. There's winners, and you always got to, people are channeling social Darwinism when you have politicians talking about winners and losers. If you hear a politician talking about, well, there's winners and there's losers, and I don't like the loser, that's social Darwinism. That's the idea that value only goes with the winners. If you want a good, handy mnemonic to realize how bad that is and how dangerous it is, think of the Nazi T4 program, where they gassed the disabled. Why did they gas the disabled? Because they were the Nazis held they had no value because they couldn't do hard work. So they couldn't fight in a competitive market. So social Darwinism is at the core of Nazism. Now, fascism is not social Darwinism of the individual. So economic libertarianism is social Darwinism of the individual. It, too, I believe, is a dangerous doctrine, but it's an acceptable doctrine to have in a free society. You know, libertarians are anti-fascists because they restrict their social Darwinism to the individual. Fascists say certain groups have more value than other groups. Americans have more value than non-Americans. Whites have more values than blacks. Jews have more values than Palestinians. That's the sort of social Darwinism of the group that you find in fascist thinking. And the idea is, and then there's this fiction that there's this hierarchy of value that's been created by hard work. The in-group, the German ideology was that Germans were hard workers, and they worked hard, and Jews were lazy. And they lived off interest and banking, and so you had to force them to do free labor. So you can distinguish the valuable group, because they're hard workers, from the lazy people. And the lazy people have lesser value, and that's the structure of the hierarchy. The lazy people are rapists and criminals, and they're lazy. The valuable people are hard workers and law-abiding, and that's how you construct the value. And labor unions, they try to make it easier. And we don't want to make the workers' lives easier, because hard work gives you value. Now, in fact, hard work is not at the center of liberalism. Like, it's not the case that you have value because you're better at working longer hours. You have value in liberalism because you are a human being worthy of dignity.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jason, anything you'd like to add before we leave?
No, I think that's how fascism works covers it, and you've done a great job of asking about its themes.
Thank you, man. I really think people should get this book, check it out, read it, pass it around. Very important, especially in this time that we're living in. So, Jason Stanley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Michael.
All right, take care. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going to go out now with a little piece I really love, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Y como dice Rubén, un carro pasa muy despacito por la avenida. No tiene marca, pero todos saben que es policía. Cuidado con las armas de Brixton.